and there's all these literature about genius and madness and the thin line between it. And I know that's offensive to some people because they're like, hey, I got the mental illness, but I don't have any of the creativity or any of the genius. How come I just get the mental illness part of it? I mean, the one thing you can control as we go through this life is your attitude, how you respond to things, being positive. And I think that's something that's kept me alive and kept me going through and able to accomplish is just the way I've been able to recalibrate my attitude into one of hope and abundance and positivity when I could have easily have succumbed to a different way of thinking where I would probably not be where I am today.
Some words of wisdom and experience from Kevin Early Bird Early, whose story was first told by his father, Pete Early, in a 2007 book called Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And now Kevin is a peer specialist with a master's degree. On today's episode, we interview Kevin Early. Welcome to our podcast, Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches. From the place where schizophrenia and real life collide.
East Coast, West Coast, Middle America.
With Miriam Feldman, Mindy Greiling, and Randy Kay.
Finally, a place to talk about the truth.
Welcome to episode 78. Very, very excited to speak today to Kevin Early Bird Early, whose father, Pete Early, was a guest on episode 49, talking about the father experience, his particular fatherhood experience, and his book, Crazy. And the book, Crazy, was a book that talked about the process of jail and people with mental illnesses going through jail. And Pete is an investigative reporter, but also peppered with his own personal story of his son who broke into a house. You'll hear more about the story and did have a brush with the law. And the title of today's episode is From Breaking Into a House to Being Invited Into One, which, spoiler alert, we're talking about the White House. So this is an episode where we get the lived experience of Pete's son, Kevin Early Bird Early, who is now a peer specialist, a speaker, an artist, a musician, and we're so excited to talk to you. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're delighted. So I do just want to give, we had in Just Us Moms episode in episode 77. But for people who are interested, I do want to give a quick update to my son who's currently incarcerated in a pre-trial situation. So he did have a court date on Monday. And praise be, as they say in Handmaid's Tale. I hate to say that, you know, but yay. I'll just say yay. It looks as though the judge has approved a program instead where he will get substance abuse and mental health treatment.
Oh,
assuming he completes that program, then his record will be wiped clean. And he's never admitted guilt. We don't even know if he did it, but the system is the system. So people who've been following that part of the story, I'm happy to say that right now, feeling really good. And I spent 5 days in Disney surviving and, alternating magic and tantrums. You know how it is, but it was amazing. And I was able to get to the court date and be in the court so that when my son was walked in, he could see that I was there. And that was kind of everything. So love matters and support matters. And, that is good news. And I could feel the weight lifting. So hopefully this will be a good chance. And in honor of that, I'm delighted that we're going to have a success story, a story of tribulations and trials and success with Kevin tonight. So I'm going to jump right in to introduce. So this is straight from your website, Kevin. So his challenges with mental health are documented by Pete Early's 2007 best-selling book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And as I said, we had Pete on for episode 49. Feel free to check it out. And there was an incident in 2002 where Kevin broke into a stranger's house, took a bubble bath, and then was apprehended by police. Jump ahead, 21 years later, and Kevin does work dealing with mental health, race, privilege, and resilience through adversity. He speaks to inspire and resolve stigma through art. Can't wait to hear about that. I've seen some of your art on the website. Currently works with youth who live with mental health issues and helps to mentor them to recover from their respective challenges. That is so exciting. So if you're new to us, I'm Randy Kay. I'm here with Mindy Greiling and Miriam Feldman. All of us are mothers of sons with serious mental illnesses. We've written 3 books, and we are advocates and mothers who refuse to quit. And we are here along with Kevin to spread a message of hope, because it's all about the stories. So welcome, Kevin. I think I would just like to start by asking you about your story.
Okay. Well, I guess it's documented in my father's book, my difficulties I had when I was college age, which is, we didn't know anything about mental illness going into this. We learned it all the hard way. I think society's a little more open to having these conversations in 2023 than it was in 2000, 2002. Basically, I was the textbook age when onset of serious mental illness occurs. And I was exhibiting textbook symptoms of mental illness, and we didn't know anything about it. And our ignorance kind of led to a series of circumstances that culminated in me being off medication, having vivid delusions, and breaking into a stranger's house, taking that bubble bath we talked about, and then being arrested by the police. This led to me being eventually going in and out of the hospital a few times. I was hospitalized about 5 times before the last time I was hospitalized. And the first 4 times I was hospitalized were all against my will, whereas the last time I was hospitalized, I actually knew I had something going on, and I decided to check myself in. And I wanted to do it without police involvement, because the other 4 times the police were involved, and it was kind of traumatic. So this led to me being referred to a program called Jail Diversion. And I had a wonderful case manager who worked for Jail Diversion. And after I graduated from that program, she saw potential in me that I did not see in myself. And she asked me to become a peer support specialist. For those who are unaware what a peer support specialist is, it's somebody with lived experience with a mental health condition. In this case, I went from getting services from the Jail Diversion program to working for the Jail Diversion program. So it's kind of like a mentor, but you're not, there's no hierarchy. You're kind of the same playing field, and you meet people where they're at. You walk with them as they go through their journey. You encourage them to do things that are better for their recovery, but you don't push them, you don't force them. You kind of, I use the analogy, you lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So my role as a peer is to kind of just keep leading them to the water, and don't get discouraged if they're not drinking it, because there were periods in my life where I wasn't drinking it, you know, so.
I want to know a lot more about the peer specialist at one point, but before we get to that, I wanted to ask actually both you, Kevin, and Randy, and I can also say for myself, because Jim, our son, has been in jail a few times as well. And I was shocked when I went to the court hearing and I was the only mother in the room. I mean, there was, most people didn't have family members, and Randy was there with her son and made it home from Disney World. And I'm guessing your father and maybe your mother too were there, Kevin. How could you both talk about how much difference do you think it makes when families are involved, when someone's connecting with the judiciary system?
I don't think I would be here if it wasn't for the love and support of my family. At the same time, the day that I was sentenced was probably the hardest day I've lived through. And it wasn't, I feel if I do a crime, I'm responsible for it. I'm not afraid to do the time. But what hurt me was the look on my parents' face and the disappointment and the sadness and the grief. I don't mind doing the time, but I could see it clearly was breaking the hearts of my parents. And that's what really hurt me more than me facing the possibility of doing time is the look on their faces pretty much.
Wow, that's really poignant. Randy, do you think it made a difference with the outcome with the judge this week for your son?
I will answer that. And then I have a question for Kevin rolling around in my mind. This is already making me cry a little bit. Yeah. So I spoke last week about how surreal it was to visit and how just like you feel like you're in a movie because, you know, had just like, what, a jail, you know, a pick up the phone, talk through a glass. And I had the same experience in the courthouse. I had never, except for, I think my ex-husband's traffic violation like a million years ago. I don't think I ever sat in, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't sit in a courtroom and I didn't really know what to do. So I walked in and happened to run in the lobby to a NAMI friend from family to family. And she said, Oh, I know what to do because I'm here for my son. And she guided me where to go. And you sit there.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
I had never met the public defender who had my son's case. We had spoken on the phone, but the amount of times I called her versus the time she called me back, those are very, like, it was 5-1. Mm-hmm. And I had to steel myself to come out in the hall and introduce myself because she said, if I'm representing you, meet me in the hall. And I went, well, I'm going out anyway, but there was that period. But once she met me, it's just something about showing up, just showing up for people. And so that's what I felt. She recognized that it was me. She remembered my phone calls. And it turns out later she did go back and tell Ben, your mother's here. So that when he walked out, and that's a sight, they're in prison scrubs and the legs are shackled and it's, you know, but he looked up and he saw me, and I know that he saw me. And I think that was at that moment, that was everything. And I spoke to him. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. So that, you know, yeah, it's huge. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I also think the judge notices, you know, the judge went the first time Jim was in a hearing after he was coming out in shackles too. The judge, well, I was the only person there, was a family member, so it's hard to miss me, but she knew I was Jim's mother. Our attorney had told her I was here. She looked directly at me and talked to me. And one of Jim's most recent hearing, I got to actually testify. So I think it's just crucial to be there. I think it matters in the result too. I think what Kevin said about, you know, you yourself wanted to do better because you saw the look on your parents' face. I think that is huge. And I also think it matters to the judge if there's an involved family. I think it means that they're more apt to take a chance on something in the community versus punishment. I just think that's a dynamic that people should know about.
So yeah, that's true. And I'm starting to think of a blog post of 10 things you need to know if someone you love is incarcerated. Number one is get the police report. You may need an appointment and it probably costs a few bucks. Get their possessions, get it from the courthouse, get it from the police station, get it from the place where they're incarcerated. Because someone I know, her son got transferred and all his wallet, everything was gone. She had to run around and get his meds. So these are lessons you learn as you're going. And, you know, just that, yeah, we've talked about this before, and this isn't about me. Kevin, I would like to ask you if it's okay, because from what I remember from your dad's book, it would have been nice if this woman had dropped charges once she understood that you had no ill intent by taking a bubble bath, but she did not. Is that correct? Do I have that, remember that accurately?
I believe so. I didn't deal with the woman. I had a order not to associate with her. My dad's the one who was pleading and
gotcha,
trying to get her to drop the charges.
Okay. So, you know, at the time,
I think what happened was she didn't show up the day of the sentencing or whatever. So I think that's why I got probation.
Okay. So jail diversion. I was just curious what you remembered about that day, but you were obviously in a state of psychosis. So I don't know if you, do you remember? I'd love to hear it from you.
Not the hearing day.
No, the bubble bath day.
Well, okay. I had a lot of delusions. A lot of them are like spiritual or religious in nature. So, I mean, it sounds absolutely insane to me now and where I'm at in my life now. But at the time, I thought an apocalypse was happening. I thought the world was ending. Obviously, the world did not end. And I was trying to seek some sort of refuge. And the reason I took a bubble bath, I was trying to clean myself from sin and make myself pure or something. So I disrobed because I thought if I was naked, I would be invisible. That's another delusion I had. So, you know, none of these things make sense to my rational mind now, but during the time they were very, like you said, when you went into the jail, it was like being in a movie. It was kind of like watching myself in third person doing these crazy things and not being able to kind of realize that it wasn't a dream or it wasn't a movie.
I discussed that you were coming on tonight with Jim, our son, because ironically, he had thoughts that he had to break into somebody's unit next to where he was living when he was in college. And then he stayed there all night and talked to a voice. And so he was really glad to hear your story. I gave him a kind of a cliff note version to know that he wasn't alone. And I think when you're telling these, you know, speaking out about these things, you really help a lot of people. Because like you said, it's common, but people don't know about it necessarily. So thank you.
Mimi, do you, you've been really quiet, and I know you kind of like jumped off a plane and came home.
She's always... You know, I don't have direct experience. Luckily, we've managed to avoid, I mean, we've had a lot of interaction with the police, but Nick has never been incarcerated or in the system at all that way. So I don't have, I'm just kind of listening and learning from you guys. I'm getting ready to hear about the artwork and the music and all that stuff.
You'll plug in there. Well, before we go to the artwork, because then I know I'm going to be quiet because I have nothing to say about that. But I just, I do want to know about your peer specialist work. Jim took the training, but then he got a relapse and never went back to it. But here in Minnesota, we are, our mental health workers are in short supply. We just got done. The governor said that people that are government workers don't need a college education because we're having so much trouble filling the positions. There's 10,000 positions in our Department of Human Services that are going begging because no one's filling them. But but yet for peer specialists, they can only work in a building such as like a hospital or an intensive residential treatment, one of those 90-day programs that, and they can't be out in the community where I think they're real, you know, I think that's where you're really needed. But the idea is they have to be working under somebody and they can't go out on their own. Is that how it is in Virginia?
We're a little more, we're in a different status than that. We aren't kept on like a leash or anything. We obviously have supervision and we report to people and we write notes and people are aware of what we're doing. But if I want to meet somebody for coffee, I take a county car, I drive into the community, I meet them at Starbucks. I did that the other day with a client and I meet them where they're at. So, when I worked in Fairfax, it was a little different. I don't work for a jail diversion program anymore. Now I work with young adults who have serious mental illness. So when I worked for jail diversion, it was a lot of going into the woods, going to the homeless shelter, going to the actual jails, going inside the jails, picking people up from jails, bringing them to the homeless shelter. Every day was like putting out a fire. My new job is a little less putting out fires. I mean, every once in a while we have a fire, but it's more about meeting people in the community and they aren't necessarily involved in the criminal justice system. So my old job had more of that element. The new job is people with autism, people with serious mental illness, schizophrenia, not necessarily involved in the justice system, though.
You know, Nick has the ACT team. And within his ACT team, there's always, it changes because the personnel does seem to change fairly often, but he always has a peer specialist or, you know, a peer, and it's basically like a friend, and it's the same thing. She goes with him to take coffee or to get a coffee or to take a walk or get him out of the house. And it's, again, what you said really resonated with me before, the idea of it's just on the same level. It's not like he's reporting to her anything. And of all the people in the wraparound team, he really likes being with the peer specialist. It's very helpful.
And I should say, there are peer specialists in ACT teams here. So I guess that's not in the building, but still they're under somebody. I don't think they have as much freedom as it sounds like Kevin does. So maybe we'll have to do that when we have so many jobs that are open. And I think I think that's where people really need a friend is, you know, if you're in the hospital, you've got lots of staff. If you're in an ERTS, you've got lots of staff. But when you're out in the community, you know, like Nibi said, that's when you need a friend. You know, people, friends are in short supply. And so peer specialists kind of cut both ways on being a friend and a staff person.
Yeah, because she gets him out of the house, which is the big thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. My son has never had a peer specialist. Never had one. We all want to know more about the rest of your life as well. But before we leave this area, can you share a little bit about your recovery, like getting from being hospitalized, you know, to where you are now? What do you attribute recovery to?
I basically had to hit a rock bottom point. For me, that was 2007. The time I mentioned where I realized I needed to go and get help, I went and got help. I tell this story that the first time you go to the mental hospital, your family shows up, your friends show up, they bring a little care package for you, they bring you snacks, visit you, they're concerned about you. The fifth time you go into a mental hospital, they just roll their eyes, they're like, yeah, he's in the mental hospital again. So I didn't want to be the person in the family who was always, I didn't want that to be my reputation. I didn't want that to be who I was. I was tired of it. I basically had to come to terms with the fact that I need medication. I didn't want to believe that I needed medication, but I realized, I looked at my life and I looked at what it was like when I was on medication and what it was like when I'm not on medication, and I couldn't argue with the results of what would happen. Also, my brother was getting ready to have his first child, and it was going to make me an uncle. He said if he wanted me involved in the child's life, but he didn't want me to be the crazy uncle. So I felt like an obligation, and I'm also very close to that family member. Because that was like 15, 16 years ago. So I've watched them grow from that period of time, and they've been an inspiration for me to stay on the straight and narrow and do what I need to do to kind of fulfill my calling or my purpose. And I think becoming a peer was also a part of my recovery, because I'm working in the social work field and because I'm working as a peer, I've got a lot of people who count on me. I'm around mental health. I'm around mental illness all the time. So it kind of keeps me from relapsing or falling back, just being around it and involved in it all the time. And another thing I want to mention, I don't know if you guys mentioned this or not, but 2020, I graduated from VCU with a master's in social work. So I actually went back to school. I studied for 4 years. I took all the tests, made a lot of sacrifices. And now I have some of that knowledge that the clinicians have. Plus, I have the lived experience, so I guess that makes me kind of like a double threat.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow. All right. Well, let's get to the art also, because there's so much more to you than this, but this is huge anyway. Mimi, have you had a chance to check out Kevin's art? You're both visual artists.
Yeah. Is that a painting of yours behind you there?
That's actually a painting my grandmother did. It's a self-portrait she did.
Nice.
So she passed, I don't remember how many years, it was several years ago she passed away. And that's one of the things I got from her. And I just keep it up there to honor her. But she was also a painter, and I went to school for painting. And that's when I had the onset of mental illness. But I do a little more music now than I do painting, but I love doing visual art too.
Yeah, and your website is getthatworm.com if you guys want to check out some of Kevin's artwork. So yeah, tell us about, I mean, there's so much. There's your art, there's your music, there's Hiding in Plain Sight, This Is My Brave, there, you know. Well, let's stay with the art and the music for now, and then tell us about the other thing.
Well, I've been making music for about 20 some years now. And it's also been a way for me to sort of think and process what I'm saying and what I believe in and what's going on in my, all the thoughts in my head. And then I kind of make music. And even if I'm the only one who listens to it, it helps me get my thoughts straight and think about what I'm going through and where I'm at in my life. It's like having a diary, but it's like an audio diary. And I just share my story and through lyrics and music. And it's something that calms me down and something that keeps me sane and give me perspective on what process things that I go through. So music, not just my music, but I listen to all sorts of other artists, and just listening to other artists helps me understand what other people are going through. And I figure they have a similar process to mine where they're trying to figure out what they're going through. And they emoted through, if you're a real artist, you kind of have something to say to the world and you have to get it out of yourself. So that's the type of art I like to listen to.
Mimi, is that how you feel too with art?
Yeah. I feel like
my question for you would be this, you know, not only I'm a painter, but my son, who has schizophrenia, is also a painter. And I'm very interested how you, let me just preface this with my situation with my son is he was a prodigious kid. I mean, he was in every art program and accepted, you know, into college early, and he was going to be an important painter, or good painter, or famous painter, or whatever you call it.
I mean, and then, this is his self-portrait, correct?
Oh, on the cover of your book? Nice.
He did that when he was 16. And they actually let me use it for the book cover. But my question would be this, because I'm wondering what your insight to this would be. He painted his whole life, and then when he got sick, the paintings expectedly got weirder and weirder and weirder. And you can kind of sort of track his illness looking at the paintings. And then he stopped painting altogether and he just started writing. And he would just write in these books, in these binders, but not stories or sentences or anything, just endless words, just stream of consciousness words. And then he went back to drawing and coloring books for many years. He would draw in adult coloring books, but not his own images. And now he's 38 and he's back to doing his own images, but it's a very different thing now. He used to paint realistic kind of images, and now he writes words on the canvas and then just fills in colors. And it's such a mirrored to his illness. And I'm just wondering, did your work in terms of visual art change from before you were sick to when you were in psychosis to now?
There was a period where I wasn't drawing or painting at all, and I think a lot of it was kind of burnout from going through art school and doing it every day for like 4 years and then kind of losing interest in it, or also being heavily medicated, and that contributed to not, I wasn't doing anything. In the period of time where I was heavily medicated, I wasn't really doing anything but sleeping. That was about sleeping and eating. That was about all I would do. So it took a while to get back into it. And after years of not doing it, one thing that I really enjoyed that I haven't been able to pick up since the pandemic happened, but before the pandemic, I used to lead an art group with a coworker of mine. And for 1 hour every week, we would draw. And a lot of the stuff on my website, the marker drawings on my website are from those sessions. I actually filled up a whole sketchbook of marker drawings, something all my years as an artist, it was the first time I'd ever filled completely a sketchbook. But we would have 1 hour every week where clients would come and I would sit and everybody would put on classical music and we just draw for an hour. And having that timed regiment of time weekly really helped keep me going as far as drawing, because you get so busy with life, you don't always have time to make art when you get home from work. So that was something visually I was able to pursue that through that art group that I led.
Did the same thing happen with music? Because Jim used to be a really good drummer and he was in the senior band when he was like a sophomore, and he was in a band in college. And then when he got sick, you know, he was just sleeping, like you said, and eating and sleeping. But even when he got to doing better, and he's doing really well right now, he thinks he's lost his rhythm. He's lost his music and he doesn't play. He sold his drum set. And I really am sorry that he lost out on that part of life. Do you have any advice?
There was, I felt like I was more creative when I was off my meds. So it took a while to kind of learn how to get that spark again. Because when you're manic, you have these highs and these depressive lows. And when you're on the highs, everything you do feels special and you feel like you're just got a main line to the creative source and you're channeling all these thoughts and images and ideas. So I miss some of that spark. And there's all these literature about genius and madness and the thin line between it. And I know that's offensive to some people because they're like, hey, I got the mental illness, but I don't have any of the creativity or any of the genius. How come I just get the mental illness part of it? But it's also like a seductive myth, because we kind of worship these people who are creative and then they're self-destructing inside. So I think it took me a while to learn how to be creative within the framework of taking the medication and not having these wild moods that vacillate between extremes. But I think it's made me a little more steady with my music output.
I'm curious, do you see a qualitative difference in the work from when you're in mania or when you're not medicated and now when you are more stable?
I can, there's some songs I made that are hard for me to listen to because of the state of mind I was in when I made it. I know I wasn't well. Because I put a lot of thought into my music and then some of it's a little more wild than the stuff that I put a lot of thought into. So I noticed the stuff I made when I was off my meds versus the stuff I make when I'm on my meds. It's got a different, definitely has a different energy.
I hear that and can totally relate to it. Now, my Ben is a poet. He's a writer. That's his art. Visually, it's not there. He had musical talent, but no persistence. So that didn't, you know, genius doesn't go far if you don't work at it. So, but like you said, Mimi, you could track Nick's illness through his art. And it was same with Ben's poetry. Like there's coherent poetry. And by coherent, I'm just defining it that I understand what he's talking about. He's written some poems that are so beautiful, publishable in my mind. And the period when he was really in psychosis, he would write poetry that I had a lot of big words, lots of big words, no idea what he's talking about. And, you know, and then when you get to the peak of it, there's that hypergraphia where it's just writing, and sometimes swirling around. And so, you know, I'm a theater artist, I'm an actor. And so my art comes out in that way. And I'm also a singer. So I, you know, I know that there's, like you said, Kevin, there's certain things I can only express through song. Certain things you can only express or feel through music. So that's sort of my art area. And through acting, there's moments in acting where I forget I'm Randy and I just become something else. And so there is that place of art. And so that's so interesting to hear your trajectory. I have two more notes here about, and I want to know why you got invited to the White House, and it may have something to do with one of these two things. What is This Is My Brave, and what is Hiding in Plain Sight?
Right. This Is My Brave. I'm going to go back to when I started going to support groups. I was living in Ashburn, Virginia. My dad's book had come out, had been out maybe like 5 years. My dad's book was nominated for a Pulitzer. It did not win, but it was a finalist. So it was kind of a big deal in the mental health world and the world at large. And I was in a support group with a woman named Jennifer Marshall. And we were going to these support groups pretty regularly and our paths crossed. And then one day, I forget how it came up, but somehow it came up that the book was about me. And she was just kind of like, I've read that book. I know that book. How did I not put it together that that was you this whole time I've been reading this book? So we had a friendship. And then she had an idea that started off in a coffee shop. She called me in and said, there was some sort of production that was going on where people would tell their stories. I forget what it was called, but she had seen some show where people would tell their stories and tell their truth and express themselves. And she said, I want to do this, but I want to do this with mental health. So she asked if I'd be on board with it. I was like, that sounds great. I think the more people talking about this, the less stigma, the more normalized it is, the less people are afraid to be honest with themselves. So I said, sign me up. I'm in for it. So she started a nonprofit. I used to be on the board of the nonprofit. I was in the first show they put on. The show is called This Is My Brave. And I wrote an original rap song for the first show that I performed in front of an audience. And that was one of the first times, it wasn't the first time I put my experience into music, but it was one of the first times I did it publicly. And we were on a bunch of news channels. And since then, This Is My Brave has gone on to like a huge success. They got shows all over the country, all over the world, people telling their stories, and started in a coffee shop with her idea to kind of put on this show.
And yeah, then I'm very familiar with that. You guys, Randy and Mindy, if you just go on Instagram and you look at the account, there's so much.
Yeah, they do a lot of shows. They do a lot.
Okay, and I'll put a link in the show notes. Is it on YouTube as well?
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Great. So I'll link to that as well in the show notes. And and Hiding in Plain Sight, is that part of the same thing, or is that something else?
It comes out in 2018. My friends Eric and Chris Ewers were working for Kim Burns, and they wanted to do a documentary on mental health, and they had read my father's book. So I wasn't the first person they interviewed, but I was one of the first people they interviewed to help secure the funding for the documentary. They interviewed a handful of people, and they had like a short teaser trailer that showed to people to get more funding to make the entire film. And through the process of that, I became very collaborative with Eric and Chris. And my artwork is featured in the documentary. My music is featured in the documentary. They took me to a very nice recording studio, the nicest one I've ever been to. And I worked with some world-class composers and a live band of session musicians that were excellent. And I took a song that I wrote back in 2005. That was the first time I had ever addressed my mental illness and music, the first time I'd ever sung about it. And I rewrote it to fit it into a song that was played with a live band. And that was featured in the closing credits of the documentary. I actually have a copy of the documentary right here.
Ah, okay. Hiding in Plain Sight. And is that available to see streaming, or is that?
I believe it's still on the PBS app. If it's not on the PBS app, it's on Amazon Prime.
Awesome.
It's on one or the other.
Fantastic.
I did see that one when it came out. It's very excellent. Very excellent. It's
very raw and very, it goes to some dark places, but we discussed that that's kind of necessary, because if we shied away from that, people going through it would watch it and be like, this isn't real. So we kind of had to go there. And it's a two-part, 2 hours each episode, but it ends on a hopeful note. So the first episode kind of ends a little gloomy, but the second episode ends on a more hopeful note. And that was a just great experience for me, having my art and my music incorporated into the film. And I got to meet some great people who were in the film who I've become good friends with, so including the directors. So it's just been a great overall experience being involved in that film.
That's amazing. And is that what got you invited to the White House, where you couldn't go because of COVID?
That is what we got invited to the White House because of our involvement in the film.
Wow.
And unfortunately, the same month I was supposed to go to a baby shower, a funeral, and then I was invited to the White House. I caught COVID. I missed the baby shower. I had to live stream the funeral through my stepbrother's phone. And then the White House, I thought I was in the clear. I went down to the building where they test you before you go in. They swabbed my nose. They said, we're going to call you in 15 minutes. If you don't get a call in 15 minutes, you're good to go. So 15 minutes passed. I was like, oh, I'm good to go. Then like 20 minutes later, they called and said like, oh, you're not good to go. So I had
Some
things weren't clear. So
I'm
hoping I get invited back another time, but
I hope so. Well, you've certainly, what you're contributing to the world and our corner of the world is spectacular and impressive. And I thank you so much for joining us tonight to share your story. Is there anything you wanted to talk about before we say goodbye that we haven't brought up?
I just want to talk about the importance of hope and positive. I don't know how to say this. I've been trying to figure out this philosophy, but it's sort of like positive thinking. I don't have the right words for it yet, but the idea of looking for hope in every situation, and not in a delusional sense, or people talk about finding silver linings, but I really think it really is. The one thing you can control as we go through this life is your attitude, how you respond to things, being positive. And I think that's something that's kept me alive and kept me going through and able to accomplish is just the way I've been able to recalibrate my attitude into one of hope and abundance and positivity, when I could have easily have succumbed to a different way of thinking where I would probably not be where I am today. So I just want to leave on a positive note. And if you're going through things that are similar to what I went through, I just say, keep going, keep your head down, and look for the community, look for the hope, look for the positivity, because it is out there. And hopefully if you look for it, you'll find that community. You'll find the people who are out there to help you and the people who can help you get to a better place where you can hopefully figure out how to give back what was given to you.
I say that the people you are a peer specialist for are very lucky.
Thank you.
I agree.
I'm wishing for your phone number so my son could call you, but I don't think he's there yet. Kevin, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you tonight, today, tonight, whenever you're hearing this. You can tell if you're on YouTube, it's dark out. Mindy's window, my window, not so much for Mimi. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been an honor to meet you, actually. So thank you.
You know, Bob was changed everything for me. That was the first book that I read about this subject. It was the only book kind of at that time that made me realize I'm not the only person.
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway. We're not alone. There are people out here, and that's why we speak about it. That's why we talk about it. That's why we do podcasts and books and music, because let people know they're not alone.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for joining us for this episode of Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches with Randy Kay, Mindy Greiling, and Miriam Feldman. To get in touch with us or to learn more about our books, please visit our websites at miriam-feldman.com, mindygreiling.com, or randyk.com.